Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And
last week we said we had a secret.
Did we say that?
Yeah, we did. We said we had a secret we would not reveal until this week.
Okay. So now the big reveal.
Dan had a big reveal, and even though tragic things have been happening in Italy, good things are happening in Italy too. It turns out that a few days ago, Mother Teresa made it to being a saint.
Yeah, that's good.
And there was much hoo-ha about that in the Eternal City, and On the Menu was there. We haven't been in Rome for an extended period of time since 2009 when we were there at Christmas time, so we decided it was long overdue time to go back.
Yeah, and we're sorry about that earthquake. It hit places that we knew pretty well, actually, in central Italy. And it's for some reason, it's earthquake-prone, Terremoto. But I have no idea why. You're the geographer. Why does it hit the Apennines?
And I don't know the answer. As I told you, it puzzles me because the geology of the Apennines is more comparable to the geology of Western Pennsylvania. We don't get a lot of earthquakes here.
Yeah, but we also don't have that kind of construction, which according to code.
But you have to have an earthquake in the first place to worry about it. So it's a very sad thing, but Rome celebrates too, as they did for Mother Teresa. They of course celebrated because On the Menu was there too. And in the next several weeks, we're going to be bringing you interviews with a number of important and interesting chefs that we met during the time we were in the city.
Yes.
So we wanted to let you know about that starting out on today's program. And we'll be back to you on that subject, of course, in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, two very interesting books crossed our radar in the last few weeks, and we wanted to bring them to you because the people writing on the subject are people who are great experts. So we get a lot of stuff on small bites and desserts, small desserts and vegan things and all that kind of stuff.
This must be a happening, something that's going to be trending soon, because we're going to interview someone about the composing the cheese plate, but this is one of two books we got. We have another one that we'll have to review in the future about the cheese plate. So cheese plates and unusual accompaniments seem to be the rule of the day.
And then the other subject is there seem to be an endless number of permutations on the subject of salad, but not one as definitive as a beautiful book just produced by OTM's good friend from New Zealand and London, Peter Gordon, of Providore's and several other restaurants in London and in his home
and
of
in New Zealand, yeah.
And he has some of the most amazing ingredients brought together to the absolute most glorious looking plate you've ever seen in your whole life. And his book is called Savor.
Salad.
Savor salad? I thought it was just Savor.
I've got it to you.
Well, not anymore. If you check out Peter Gordon, on bookshelf, on OTM bookshelf or on Amazon or wherever your favorite supplier is, he'll show up for sure. And this is a book that ought to be in your collection. And, better than I tell you, what will happen is you'll realize when you're listening to Peter that you're listening to a real expert and someone who's going to make you look great in the kitchen.
Savor salad.
Savor salad. There you go. You were right. You're always right.
Let's start
with OTM's good friend, Peter Gordon, talking to us all the way from London.
Listeners, we're going to be talking to an old friend here, Peter Gordon, who is from New Zealand with properties around the globe, but also in London now. You'll have to tell us again, you have Providore's, but you also now have a donut business?
We do, yeah. We've got a, in London, we've got a business. There are a group of us, a lot of good friends, a company called Crosstown, and we are doing very nice donuts.
Gourmet donuts. Yes, gourmet and listeners, donuts. You could just Google Gourmet Donuts London and you'll get all the info on that. Well, we're supposed to be talking, Peter, about your newest book, which is Savor, Salads for All Seasons, which is, as I read it, I mean, you said it was like an update of what your book from, was it 2010, a decade ago or so?
It is, yes, yes.
But I think it's all original. How much new material is there?
All the recipes are brand new. I mean, there's a watermelon feta salad that is something that I remember eating long, long time ago, and I'd put that in a book many years ago. And so there's a revision of that which has some sumac and some capers and a little bit of mint in there, which I think is a yummy thing. But all the 100 or so recipes are all brand new, actually.
Well, they're very exciting.
The introduction is I guess, what is... Because when I had to write the book, I thought, okay, well, 10 years ago I did a book on salads, and now what will my introduction be? And I thought, actually, it's kind of... My opinion hasn't changed. I still think salads should be a textural contrast. The way you make a salad dressing, it hasn't changed. So, yeah, the book is new.
What makes something a salad?
I'd say a salad is a whole lot of components kind of put together sort of last minute, rather than something like a soup or a casserole where you keep adding ingredients to the mixture and then you cook it out. So I'd say a salad is a sort of a composition of disparate ingredients that have been put together. They may still have processes done to them, like a pear may be poached or some buckwheat may be fried and crispy, but it's kind of a last-minute assemblage.
Now, you have a credit for photography by Lisa Linder, and the photography is absolutely luscious.
Isn't that beautiful?
Oh, gorgeous. I was curious about the graphic work, like just before the page opposite, when you're introducing a new chapter, there's kind of like a little abstract doodle. What is that?
Well, that's a lovely Australian woman called Ashley who, because the book is designed by a friend of mine, her name's Kaz Hildebrand, and she's done all sorts of books from the last sort of five Ottolenghis and the Bocca di Lupo and Morrow cookbooks. And Kaz is a good friend, and she's part of the reason that I live in this part of London and Hackney.
Uh-huh.
And Ashley, who was working for her, who's done the illustrations, is an Australian woman who was living here, and she kind of picked up the vibe of the book. So it's been a very much collaborative, the visual side is very collaborative, through some old friends and some sort of new friends. And with Lisa's photography, we, like all my books, we always shoot them at home. We don't use lights. Everything's done. I mean, I've moved house. This is my eighth book, and I've lived in four houses during that period, but every time I shoot a book, it's always me cooking the food, and it's always done in my living room or the lounge or the kitchen.
Well, you're amazing. I mean, first of all, I guess I better mention what we were talking about is that, well, I haven't seen you in about 5 years, but I saw pictures in this book of you, and you haven't aged a bit, and what did you tell me that was attributed to?
I think it's a good, healthy diet, a diet and balance.
Lots of salads, right?
Lots of salads.
It's all about the salads, yeah.
Well, you know, I want to get into your brain. I read a lot of cookbooks, and I do a lot of cooking, and I have cooked for years, and I think I'm fairly inventive, but I can't get a handle on how you come up with all these, you would think they were disparate ingredients and make them work. I mean, I'm looking at this miso-baked aubergine, which is eggplant, dates, feta, crispy buckwheat, and tahini yogurt. Now, where did that come from?
Well, it's a kind of a mashup of Japanese and Middle Eastern cuisine. And when I'm creating a dish, whether it be a salad or something on the restaurants in London or New Zealand, it's I suppose I think of things as characteristics or traits that I think each ingredient has. And the Japanese do lovely sort of miso-baked aubergines, which I've done in all sorts of different ways. But I thought also what I love is that The miso goes really well with sesame with tahini. And mm-hmm. The Japanese also use atari goma, which is kind of a Japanese version of tahini paste. I thought, how can I just keep introducing the sesame thing? And so it became tahini, and then there was a bit of yogurt, there was the miso aubergines, and then even though it was rich, I thought it needed something sweet, and I thought the dates would do that really well, and then the dates sort of speak to the tahini, and then the feta just adds this lovely saltiness and wonderful seasoning. Plus, it looks very nice. And I think a salad should look good.
Well, these look beautiful.
Oh, and it's a dish that we have on the menu at the Sugar Club in Auckland and also at the Providors in London. And it's one of our biggest selling salads. I'm super happy with that one.
Well,
good choice.
I bookmarked another one because it has a story I thought you'd tell us. I don't know where you thought of this. Chili chocolate teriyaki mackerel with Samfer, Jersey Royals, and orange. Oh, my.
And it's delicious. And the story behind that is there's a fantastic chocolatier in the UK and London, England, Paul A. Young, and he just does remarkable chocolates. And we did a series of dinners with Paul where we used chocolate in dishes, and we didn't want it to be a series of dinners where everything has like a Mexican mole sauce. And so in the recent dinners we did, we had an octopus dish with green mango and grated chocolate. But we also made a teriyaki sauce that we enriched with chocolate, which when you think about sort of the characteristics of a teriyaki sauce, that it's a bit salty and a bit sweet and a bit savory, a really dark chocolate, when you add it to the mix, just actually makes it even better. So we glazed some beef with that, and we've also glazed some fish, and the oily mackerel with its skin on works really, really well. And then the samphire is fresh, the oranges give it a nice tang, the Jersey Royals, which are
paraphernals
of Jersey, it works. It just kind of works. It's a really nice but surprising dish.
Well, I'm going to give you this next dish here, and I want you to tell me, like, what ingredient or what idea did you start with, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's frika, which I love, cumin roast artichoke, grilled corn, and pomegranate.
Well, the frika, where I live in London, there's a lot of sort of Turkish shops and stores, which I do a load of my sort of shopping from, and I love the sort of the smokiness that frika has. So I was keen in the book, there are different chapters, but one of them is on grains, and I thought, it'd just be nice to put in some slightly unusual grain. So the frika has a lovely smokiness. It's a green wheat that in Turkey, there are two ways of doing it. You can either harvest the grains and then you kind of dry them in a kiln type thing, or you set fire to the fields and the burning chaff sort of adds a smokiness to the frika before it's harvested. And what I like about it is that it's quite a dry grain. It's not like lentils when you cook them that have a sort of viscosity to them. So I wanted to create something that was vaguely Turkish. Some of my favorite memories of artichokes are when you're in Turkey, you can go to the markets and you buy them. They're already prepped, which I just love because they save so much time. And then the grilled corn has a smokiness and the pomegranate has a lovely tang. And it all sort of comes together with some cumin and some pumpkin seeds and dill. And dill to me is a very Turkish herb because until I started going to Turkey, and I've probably been about 60 times now, I'd never enjoyed dill. I'd always seen it as a kind of a Scandinavian herb. And then in Turkey, I realized that actually it goes really well with tomatoes, it goes really well with sort of fish, all sorts of things. So to me, that's a lovely, slightly smoky, really textural, pretty salad.
Now, before we leave the subject of frika, did you ever run across the guy from South Australia who was producing frika?
No. No, I haven't.
We met,
I imagine I don't sit part of their field there.
Yeah, we met him years ago.
Oh, okay.
We interviewed him, and I can't remember how we ran across him. And he had a shipment. He had a tanker full of frika that was supposedly on the high seas, coming from Australia to the west coast of the United States. And he was going to let us know when it arrived, and we never heard from him again.
Oh, was there a storm or something?
I have a feeling I have a feeling that maybe he was about as truthful as the guy who told us about how many truffles he was producing in Tasmania.
Oh, okay.
But you know the story of how frika was developed, right?
No.
Apparently, there were these people who were living in a fortified city of some kind in Mesopotamia,
mm-hmm.
and they heard in advance that the nasty enemy was coming their way, so they realized that they would have to have a siege. But it was in the middle of the wheat season, so they didn't know what to do. So they decided that they would harvest the wheat even though it was green.
Mm-hmm.
So they totally stripped the fields and they stored the green wheat, and the green wheat obligingly exploded because it fermented with all the things that were in that they hadn't removed because they hadn't ripened yet. So all of a sudden they had all this burnt grain.
Mm.
They didn't have anything else to eat, so they ate it.
I find it pretty delicious.
Yes, I love it.
They decided it was okay after all. And that's
it was
how
Mesopotamia or something.
Mesopotamia, yeah, the land between the rivers.
Yeah.
When another person we talked to, who started this black garlic craze were these two young Koreans.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to market it to the world as a health supplement. And we talked to them, and I didn't realize till later that it was the middle of the night in Korea when they called. I said the chefs would be interested in this as the taste flavor component. And why don't you go that route instead of a health supplement with a limited audience? And said they did. And it's gone everywhere.
Oh, and it's lovely, isn't it? It's like
I had so much of it. They were so grateful. They sent us
overload.
A lifetime supply of it. And I didn't really know all to do with it. Now you have a really amazing recipe in your book, where you use it to good advantage with roast chicken, kumquats, which is something else I love, but I never in my life would have thought to put kumquats and chicken with black garlic, kale, and avocado. How did you think of that, Peter?
I guess it's just, I mean, I suppose the food that I do, that I call fusion, and I have a love-hate relationship with the word, but I just honestly don't know what other word to do with it. I love chicken thighs. I love sort of the tanginess of kumquats, and you know, I thought that they have a total opposite sort of effect to the black garlic, which is rich and molassesy and, you know, texturally quite mushy. And then I thought if you had it and it's all quite rich, well, you know, the chicken thighs and the garlic and stuff, and then you want to have it with something really refreshing, so that it's almost like duck a l'orange using the kumquats, and then you add it to the kale, the avocado and the cucumbers and raw red onion, and you've suddenly got this lovely fresh, you're kind of adding this fresh component to this slightly rich and luxurious thing, and it just comes together super, super well,
that's
really.
Beautiful platter.
Yeah, we should have mentioned that. No, in we have the advantage, of course, that we're looking at this beautiful book and beautiful pictures. But salads for you are more than just an assemblage of raw ingredients. I mean, you couple them with really what would otherwise be main dishes that wouldn't be nearly as interesting. So you have a whole chapter on fish. You have a whole chapter on fowl. You have a whole chapter on meat. All of which echo with a sort of a salad-y looking thing that's with them. But if you're like me and it's not a meal if you don't have meat on the plate, there's a place for you here as well.
Yeah, there is. Probably people have always said this with every book they do, but the book came out in the UK in March and in New Zealand in April or May. And it's been really interesting because I've done lots of festivals and book signings and stuff around the country, or both countries, and it's been really, people are just engaging with it. They're finding, I think it's the constraint of, they don't have to plate everything and make all these, because the recipes, in my mind, most of them, are fairly simple. You know, you do need to do a bit of shopping, but I, as someone who loves shopping, that's never been a problem for me, and I think in this day and age with the internet and, you know, various other ways of shopping, you can get a lot of ingredients really easily, and through the book I try and make sure that every ingredient is used in at least two recipes, so you're not buying a 200 gram jar of black garlic and then think, okay, well I've done that chicken recipe, what else will I do? Because further on in the book there's this lovely black garlic aioli, where for people who struggle with making mayonnaise, It's a very strange recipe that uses milk, garlic and oil and nothing else. And in this one, I've used some black garlic. So the person who buys the black garlic isn't going to be stuck with a tub of it in the fridge thinking,
there's a reason for all of these ingredients.
Yeah.
And
I think my food is all about flavor, really. It's you know, interesting ingredients. And there was probably a time where all your listeners probably, well, many of them probably would remember a time before olive oil was popular, before pomegranate molasses was popular, but maybe even before cumin was popular. So, you know, all these ingredients are being used by someone somewhere in the world for the most days of the week, really.
And, you know, most of these conveniently are to be served either at room temperature or hot, right?
Yes, yeah.
These are not cold salads.
Not really. The watermelon salad you have cold, and some of the tomatoes. There's a lovely burrata with heritage tomatoes and a dressing made from mangoes and green chili and a bit of ginger, which sounds a bit bonkers, you know, serving buffalo mozzarella burrata with mango. But actually, if you close your eyes and you kind of picture the combination, you might think, well, historically that's never happened, but if mangoes grew in sort of around Naples and stuff, I'm sure that, you know, there'd be a classic Italian dish of mangoes with mozzarella. It's just that it hasn't happened before.
Well, now the good news for us here and for listeners here is that the book is now available in the United States, because that's how we got a copy.
Yes.
We got a copy less than a week ago, by the way. Just to give you an idea how excited we were to get you on the program.
Because
well, let's do this before we forget, because a lot of listeners who, when asked what they make for dinner, they say they make reservations.
I like your listeners too, because they're a restaurant too.
Exactly.
I wanted to make sure we got that into the recording so that people realize that in fact, if they're in London, all they have to do is go to Marylebone High Street, and there they'll find not just one but two restaurants, one called the Tapas Room in the front, and then Providor is upstairs. And that was your original venture. But before that, I think, if I'm recalling correctly, you worked at a London restaurant called the Sugar Club.
Yes.
I did, yeah. The Sugar Club opened in Wellington originally in New Zealand in 1986.
It's still there, isn't it?
Then Notting Hill 95, then Soho in 98. And then I opened up the fourth version of the Sugar Club back in Auckland 3.5 years ago. And if your listeners have been to Auckland, and there's the Sky Tower, this big, huge, tall tower up on the hill, my restaurant's up on the 53rd floor there. So that I have the Sugar Club there, and then a Spanish tapas bar that turns 10 this year called Beota, down on the street level. So, yeah.
And
that's where you are. I mean, I wanted to do an update every so often. I have to find out what you're doing new.
So the one called Kopapa is no longer part of the Gordon Empire.
No. Kopapa had a fantastic 5.5 years. And then because of our other business that we mentioned, Crosstown Donuts, because that's just going from strength to strength, someone made us an offer and we were like, oh, no, we don't want to do that. And then we thought about it and we thought, you know, let's try and concentrate. Instead of doing lots of things not so well, let's try and do a couple of things better. And so that was kind of our guiding principle, really, when we decided to sell the business, to sell Kopapa.
Now, you're still making wine? You do that,
no,
too?
No, unfortunately, the wine company, that is no longer
us. Wow.
No, that was a fun ride, because I went to university when I was 17 to study to become a winemaker. And so, you know, from an early age, I've kind of had an interest in wine. And then in my sort of 30s, late 30s, I had an opportunity to put some money into a vineyard with some friends. And then it just kind of, we produced delicious wine, and we had great accolades from people like Jancis Robson and stuff. But it just kind of, someone once said, if you want to make a small fortune in wine, you set out with a large fortune.
That's Peter Saber,
right? I think that's true.
That's it exactly. Now, just in case there's still some out there on people's wine, on restaurant wine lists and in the back of some wine shops, give us the name of the wine, because I've forgotten. I remember the taste.
It's called Waitaki Braids, and it's in North Otago, and it's on The reason I came up with that name, it's on a braided river. I don't know if you have those in the States, but they're the rivers that sort of meander. They're very wide sort of riverbeds, and they have little islands and piles of sand in them. So they're a braided river, almost like a lace sort of thing. And the Waitaki River is one of the last braided rivers in the South Island, and it's this crystal blue. It's like someone has got a added a bottle of turquoise colouring to a milk bottle or something. It's got a lovely colour. And there's loads of wild salmon, and there's some wasabi that had escaped from someone's property growing on there. And it was truly the most beautiful thing, and it still is an amazing region. But for us it was just, there was a very little infrastructure in the region. So even though there were sort of nine of us growing grapes, people would say to me, oh, we're going to go down to the Waitaki Valley and we're going to go and have lunch in your restaurant on the vineyard. And it's like, there is no restaurant. There's a small town nearby that you can buy a meat pie or some fish and chips. But yeah, it wasn't very glamorous. So it's beautiful. I have a real soft spot for it, but it was just one of those businesses that didn't quite go as expected.
Well, now, Peter, in case we don't catch up with you in London, which I hope we do soon, we'll probably catch up with you in Melbourne for the next year's version of the 50 Best Restaurants.
Oh, well, maybe I'll need to duck across and go, because that's where I did my apprenticeship in Melbourne.
Uh-huh.
I love Melbourne. I see Melbourne, I think this week they just announced the best cities in the world to live in. Melbourne, for the second year running, has come out of number one.
Well, we lived in Geelong,
It's really amazing what's happened to Melbourne. It used to be such a boring city.
It used to be very boring.
And now it's gotten really cosmopolitan, really exciting culturally. It's just a great place to visit, and we haven't been there
there for the Food and Wine Festival, and then something else came up and we couldn't go.
So surely
we'll be there for the 50 best.
Yeah, Wells 50 best might get us there. And that's just for your long-term planning. And
we'll have a mother and a sister who live a couple of hours in Gippsland, southeast of Melbourne. So I fly into Melbourne once or twice a year, and then I generally just scoot down. So maybe I need to sort of coordinate a visit with you guys.
Well, the world's best is supposed to be sometime in April. No definite date beyond that yet.
Okay.
But if you follow Wells 50 Best with their newsletter, they'll keep you up to date on what's going on.
Right. Because I think this year did a lot of top Australian chefs fly to New York or something to do an event to help promote the 50 restaurants. I think it was
Shuri
from Attica in Melbourne, who's a Kiwi guy actually, and Neil Perry and some of the others stuffed over.
We didn't get to hear about all the events, but I'm sure that's probably true. Probably because they were going to announce that it was going to move to.
The thing I'm sorry we missed was they did a promotion. Australia did a promotion, or it was Tasmania. They had all the top chefs arriving in Tasmania for dinner, which is really amazing. It's probably the most people Tasmania has ever seen.
Tasmania's having a great time. I mean, I do a leukemia charity each year in London, and also one in New Zealand. And our next one in New Zealand is October, and we're flying a chef over from, well, we've got a chef coming in from Mendoza in Argentina. And we've got three Australians and someone from Bali, and then a group of chefs from around New Zealand. And the food in Tasmania that I've been following, this chap, he's got a restaurant there called Franklin. And it's just amazing, because the produce in Tasmania is, you know, the fish and the dairy, amazing stuff.
Peter's cousin grows organic avocados there.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, you bet.
You better get to the Shaw plantation.
Wow. Gosh.
Yeah, Richard Shaw, Dick Shaw.
Yeah.
So, he sells every one that he can produce.
Yeah, he can sell them to Russians for $3 a piece.
Anyhow, we could go on. I miss talking to you, Peter Gordon.
Jack. Oh, it's lovely talking to you both. Yeah. Really, really nice.
Hope we'll catch up with you in person sooner rather than later. And in the meantime, congratulations on a truly beautiful book.
Remember, it's called Savor Salads for All Seasons. And this is Chef Peter Gordon we're talking to. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you very much. Really nice. And I'll see you in London, hopefully, eh?
I hope so, yes.
Okay.
And we're going to take a short break, but don't go away because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and we actually have the full title of the next book.
Oh, we do. Good. What's the full title?
Composing the Cheese Plate.
Okay.
So, and we're going to be talking to Brian Kieser, or is it Kieser?
Kieser, I think you said.
And who co-wrote it with Lee Friend. And let's listen to.
Well, hold on a second. Who would have thought it, Brian? Has a whole new concept in dining because he has a restaurant based mostly around cheese.
Cheese and wine.
And the most unusual thing, most unexpected, is we discovered in the midst of our conversation that in the next 2 weeks he's going to open a cheese restaurant here in our OTM's home city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Yes. It's his restaurant.
Go ahead.
Toro's Casalula.
Casalula, and it's in a development called the Asylum. Now, go figure with that one.
No, a City of Asylum.
City of Asylum?
It's an organization that we're very proud of in the city.
Okay.
They just got a new headquarters, but they sponsor and help artists, writers who were.
Got it. So it's sort of like the artistic equivalent of the Sanctuary City thing that everybody's fighting about in Philadelphia right now.
Is that what they're doing?
Yeah, right? I don't quite understand Sanctuary City, but apparently Philadelphia is one, and a lot of people don't think that's a good idea. But I'm sure that
the City of Asylum is a good idea.
I'm sure it's a great idea. But it was something of a surprise to find out about something that we just didn't know right out of the blue. Anyway, back to Brian Kieser.
And Lee Friend. Every so often, and we get quite a lot of books, but every so often I get one that knocks my socks off, and that's the one I'm looking at now, Composing the Cheese Plate. Recipes, Pairings, and Platings for the Inventive Cheese Course by Brian Kieser and Lee Friend. And you know what? Truly, although many books promise inventive recipes, in this book, that's where you're going to find them. I think you two are geniuses at this.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that's very nice.
How are you supposed to respond to that?
Yeah, how do you? Brian, you have a restaurant called Casalula?
Yes. It's called Casalula Cheese and Wine Cafe in New York City in Hell's Kitchen. And I'm in the process of opening another Casalula in Pittsburgh right now.
What? Where?
Surprise.
Yeah, where?
On the north side of Pittsburgh, in the Mexican War Streets neighborhood.
That's a great neighborhood to be in.
Yeah, it really is. I'm really excited about it.
Dana, I think I dreamed that.
From your lips to God's ears, huh?
So when does this happen?
We should be opening coincidentally about the same date as the official release of this book, September 13th.
Okay, well, so here we have, that goes right at the top of the list here. And what is your connection to Pittsburgh?
I personally don't have a connection to Pittsburgh. I actually was called by some lovely people there who run a nonprofit and we're building a cultural center.
Oh, you're the one going into the City of Asylum.
This is going into the City of Asylum.
Oh, I just read about that. I read an article, where was it, and I just tweeted it.
Oh, great.
Oh, good.
Well, you were promoting us without even knowing
it. Yeah. So, anyhow, well, that's really great. And you two met when?
We met soon after I opened Castalula in 2007. We were much busier than we expected and serving a lot more food and cheese than we expected, and so our chef needed some help, and my friend Alan Stafford was working for me at Castalula then, and he had just left Gramercy Tavern, and he said, I know someone from Gramercy Tavern who I think might be right for the job.
Yeah, and she now,
to Lee.
And Lee, as I read in your book, really expected she was just going to be making desserts and doing pastries and things, and you said, ha ha. And she decided she really got into it, right?
Yeah, I didn't really have to say much. She just has a really good nose, and she saw opportunity, I think, Lee.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that really attracted me to Castalula was that they were approaching cheese in a way that I had never seen it before, highlighting it the way that, you know, we do in the book. We realize that it's a food product that deserves to be given the attention of, say, let's say, some chefs would approach a cow, a grass-fed beef, or an estate olive oil. And so Castalula was really kind of breaking out of the box and showing cheese in a new way, and that every cheese has a different character and deserves to be paired with something to complement that. And so that was very exciting for me. I have a pastry chef background, but it was in this place where I could also use my savory inspirations as well.
Uh-huh. And so you do that with this.
Absolutely.
Yes. How is your cafe different from, say, artisanal ones? Is artisanal closed for a long time? Artisanal? Remember artisanal?
No, absolutely. I mean, I would say that our approach to cheese at Castalula is a little bit different because while we do highlight the cheeses from all over the world, the approach at Castalula is that we use these recipes to pair a specific accompaniment with each one of these cheeses. We believe that each cheese has its own character that just needs to be played with. And that not every cheese plate should be served with honey, nuts, or mustard.
Right.
We saw the opportunity of the different flavor combinations that can be complemented. And also what we like to call the third experience is when you have a cheese and a pairing and you create a third experience, which is another flavor profile that comes from combining those two.
It's interesting. Somebody once quoted General de Gaulle of France, saying, how do you govern a nation that has 450 kinds of cheeses? Now the amazing thing about it is he probably can't count because there are probably at least 1,450 different cheeses in Paris.
Yeah, but I've heard 2,000. But yeah, there are a lot of cheeses in France.
But
certainly many thousands in the world.
But you report in the foreword of your book that you are analyzing the number of different accompaniments that you had put with cheese as you were working together, and it came to well over 100.
Yeah, I don't know. Lee, did you ever come to an actual count of how many different condiments you make?
It was a lot. I remember it was a lot.
No, I have not come up with an actual count because that is always growing. I mean, that's the fun thing about the culinary world, it's a world that is ever-growing, and it doesn't get stale, that's for sure.
So are you still a fromager, or are you a pastry chef masquerading as a fromager, or is it both?
I would consider myself a chef by trade. I have, many titles in there, but I would say that I'm a chef by trade who is very passionate about cheese and all things cheese.
Which comes first, the cheese or the accompaniment, when you two are planning?
That depends.
It changes all the time.
Yeah.
So sometimes in the restaurant, sometimes the fromager will come to the pastry chef and say, I've got this new cheese, let's sit down and taste it.
Okay.
And decide which pairings we want to put with it. And other times the pastry chef will say, hey, I was at the Green Market and I got this really fresh rhubarb or this beautiful corn and I want to do something with it. Let's find a cheese or some cheeses that will match that.
Great. I don't know even where to start here. I want to give some information about the book, though, that you do explain the varieties, the basic varieties of cheese. And you also discuss how to buy it, how to preserve it or take care of it. And then we're moving on to the real inspirational side of it, what you can possibly put with it and serving it. Is there anything I left out of that? I mean, it's an oversimplification.
No, I think that's pretty good. The centerpiece of the book is the 70 recipes for easy, fun pairings for your cheese course. But we also try to teach the reader so that they have the knowledge and the tools that they need to create their own thoughtful cheese plates.
Right. Now, this
so that means telling you what the categories of cheese are, talking about different milks, talking about the different regions, seasonality, the occasion, platings, presentation, all sorts of things like that.
I have a bumper crop of husk cherries. We call them ground cherries. And you actually have an accompaniment to cow's milk. You say Renaissance ricotta?
Yes, that's actually one of my favorite pairings. It's a very seasonal pairing. I mean, ground cherries and husk cherries, sometimes also known as gooseberries, have a very short season, and it is a little bit labor-intensive. I do get them at the local Green Market here in New York City. It's a small little cherry that looks like a small little yellow tomatillo.
Yeah.
And these are bursting with flavor, and they have a really unique kind of pineapple, almost tropical fruit aroma.
Yeah.
And when you add them with a little bit of sugar and a little bit of vanilla, and you cook them down slowly just to kind of concentrate those flavors and sugars, you end up with a beautiful husk cherry compote that tastes a little bit reminiscent of birthday cake.
I thought that was kind of cute about a birthday cake. But you know what convinced me you knew what you were doing with this? You added 2 teaspoons of lemon juice. I really respect and trust only chefs that add a little bright citrus in it. In the recipe.
And she has a prejudice against chefs who put sugar in things.
Yeah.
Especially pasta sauce.
Oh, that's pasta sauce, my goodness.
Well,
we do believe that a little bit of acid with these accompaniments is actually very complimenting. And what that acid is going to do in those pairings is help kind of take away some of that fat off your palate and lift that up so that the flavors can combine in your mouth.
Now, where do you come down on the controversy over whether or not you should drink red wine or white wine with a cheese course? Because that's a good way to get an argument going with most people. around this house, we would swear by red, and then, you know, if we stopped 100 people in the street, 95 of them would say, "You can't possibly mean that. You must serve a Riesling or."
I have 2 different responses to that.
Please.
I think on one hand, Americans tend to think of beverages to pair with cheeses in what is probably the exact opposite way that they should be. Like most Americans would say red wine first, then white wine, when really the best things with cheese are things with bubbles. So sparkling wine and beer. Those would be my ideal pairings with cheese. And then There are a lot of cheeses that are great with white wine, and there are some cheeses, the harder cheeses, aged cheeses, more robust cheeses that are good with red wine. But in general, red wines, especially high alcohol, full-bodied ones, can overwhelm a lot of cheeses. So if you've got a plate that's got a variety of cheeses, like a fresh and a bloomy, something like a camembert, maybe in addition to some more robust cheeses, the red wine is going to overwhelm those lighter cheeses, and you're not going to be able to fully experience them.
Yeah, I mean, I like
the other thing I believe is that you should drink whatever you want with whatever you're eating.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to have a full-bodied Cabernet Sauvignon with your cheese plate, and that's what makes you happy, then that's exactly what you should do.
Yes, Ed. So if you want Coca-Cola in your red wine, that's what you should have.
Nope, I draw the line before that.
Interestingly enough, what was the name of George Perrier's restaurant in Philadelphia?
Le Bec Fin.
Supposedly, the maitre d' at Le Bec Fin was so thoughtful about customers that he had a customer who came in who ordered a very expensive French Bordeaux. But then he said, I need to sweeten it up a little bit. Can you put some Coca-Cola in it? And not fazed at all. The maitre d' did exactly that. And not only that, the next time this guest came back, they asked him if he'd like the usual, and he had it already prepared behind the stairs.
Wow. I understand that people should do exactly what makes them happy, but it does break my heart a little bit when somebody drinks a really high quality wine and dilutes it with sugar. That just hurts.
You know, you have another recipe in here that would give any sommelier the heebie-jeebies, which is a Mad River Blue with lemon roasted asparagus.
Well, we like to have, but I mean, a lot of sweet pairings do naturally go very well with cheese because cheese, milk is a naturally sweet thing, but we do like to have fun with savory accompaniments as well, and that for sure is one that is very savory. The Von Trapp Mad River Blue in itself is already a little vegetal. It has a little bit more of a savory blue. You're also going to get some of that grass and hay quality in the milk, and that's really because this is a farm-fed cheese where a lot of the conditions on the farm are also affecting how that milk is going to taste after it is aged. And with something like lemon roast vegetables, it's very savory, but that little bit of, lemon roast asparagus, but with that little bit of lemon, it's just going to brighten up those really nice, sweet vegetal flavors that are found in fresh spring asparagus.
But you are right. That would be a challenge for any sommelier to find the right.
Yeah,
we had that.
What was it we had in, was it in Chicago?
We were at a restaurant called 16 in Chicago just a few weeks ago. And the dish came out. I think it had both artichokes and asparagus.
That was it.
and we were chatting with the chef because he wasn't all whited up and cooking yet. And, we said, well, what wine is going to go with this? And he said, my sommelier and I have not been able to agree.
And they served it with Chablis, which was way off.
Which was altogether
terrible.
To us dear.
Can you imagine that? With artichokes and asparagus?
I'm just guessing. I sometimes am wrong with my guesses, but I would go with an IPA. That's got a little bit of bitterness to it.
We actually went with a sparkling white.
That's probably a good call. That worked
a hell of a lot better than the Chablis, shall we put it that way anyway.
Now listen, I'm going to run through some of these, what I consider wonderfully oddball accompaniments for cheese, and I'd just like a brief comment on them. Like, here's a stunner. We have a chev, and we have, which is goat cheese, and we have with a baba ganoush, which is in itself kind of what would we call it? Strident. So, what were your thoughts on that?
Well, the Dalbertson news, I really thought that that was a fun pairing to come up with. Because I personally love, all things kind of the, Middle Eastern, tapas, shall we call it. And I think that those types of tapas pair really well with other foods. And the baba ganoush is really fun because eggplant is already something that some people either love or hate. So this is a pairing that could be a little bit challenging for some. But I think that if, taste it and you start to, see how the roasted eggplant really complements that bright, tangy chèvre with a little hint of garlic and some parsley and lemon, you'll be pleasantly surprised about that.
And what do you drink with that? Grappa or arak? or Strega?
Whatever you like.
There's an ingredient in here I bet you could have a lot of fun with. We were on a kick a while back of using fresh turmeric root. And it was fun. Peter made a cocktail with it. He called it, what was it?
It's a tumertini.
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 Okay, more of these sides now, or these are coming with. Sweet and sour lotus root, which is stunning to look at, isn't it?
Yeah, that's one of my favorites visually on the plate. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, what could be wrong with lotus root? I think that the sweet with the savory works here through honeycomb with a blue goat.
Yeah, the sweet and sour lotus root is a fun pairing because the lotus root actually plays as kind of a little bit of a blank slate for flavor, but adds quite a bit of texture. Lotus root, we buy it prepared, which just means that it's literally been peeled, kind of cut up in a simple water salt solution. It's ready for you because lotus root is quite perishable. So it's an easy convenience for them to package it this way. So it maintains quite a bit of its crunch, very much like a water chestnut. And the sweet and savory flavors, and also umami, there's a little bit of fish sauce in that recipe as well, really allow the flavors of that goat cheese, Spanish goat cheese, to shine. And the depth from the sweet and sour lotus root really comes out.
And I have one more here that I've been dying to ask you about, is this saffron-infused marshmallow.
Sure. And so the lovely lemon saffron marshmallows, these are light, fluffy, delicate marshmallows that are really going to add a lot of texture with a little kiss of bitterness from the saffron and a little tanginess from the lemon. This is a really fun pairing because we pair it with softer cheeses so that when you chew it, everything kind of just has this springy texture throughout your mouth, and it's very rich and luxurious and creamy, which a lot of people love. Everyone has their favorites.
I can't wait to make some of these things. They look so enticing.
Yeah, and the marshmallows are really fun because they're a surprise to almost everybody who tastes them. Like, obviously not the thing that most people think of when they're pairing things with cheeses.
Right. Well, I mean, I always tell people who are doing the homemade marshmallows that I must have been a grown woman before I realized they didn't, marshmallows didn't come off of bushes.
Marshmallow trees?
Yeah, well, bushes. I never went full tree.
Okay.
Anyhow, well, this is a delightful book. Let's repeat. It's Composing the Cheese Plate. And it's Brian, is it Kaiser or Kaiser?
Kaiser.
Kaiser. And Lee Friend. And
we'll see you soon in Pittsburgh, we hope. We expect you'll be here very soon. We'll be getting back into the country just a few days before you open.
So really? Sure, well, I'll be there in about 6 hours, so I'll be getting ready for you.
And that's a wrap for this week. We'll be back with some interesting food and drink-related stuff from the Eternal City of Rome next week. Same time, same place. We hope you'll join us then. And until then,
bye-bye.